Going to open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Today is February the 19th. And I, having one of our colleagues here to talk about his bill, am going to ask that Representative Huffman join us, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2038.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Klim. Great to be here.
Welcome.
I was hoping to have two bills in front of you, but sometimes that's just the way it works. It's not the first time in the last year and a half that Washington has killed something we've been trying to do. But anyway, I digress. John Huffman, state rep out of House District 59. And I was approached a couple of years ago by a couple of airport operators, rural operators out of the Dallas airport, Rolf Anderson and Chuck Covert, that wanted me to work on a legislative concept, which turned into 2038. And so I reached out to Mitch Swecker, the director of aviation for Oregon, and he put me in touch with Mr. Phil Olson, who is behind me, and he and Dave Honeycutt are going to be testifying to the meat of the bill. But the more I got to working on this bill, which Phil can correct me when he comes up if I'm wrong, I believe this bill was attempted to be introduced at the end of the 2013 session with Vicky Berger, but it was just too late in the session to really have hearings and properly vet it. And so we decided to bring it back this session, and I think it's a bill, as you'll hear in testimony, that kind of brings us into uniformity with all the other states. Oregon is kind of out on its own as far as rural airstrip liability, and so we just want to kind of codify some of the efforts that we're trying to move forward. And like I say, got some good testimony following me, because everybody knows that I don't provide the good testimony.
So should we have Dave and Phil?
That would be great. Yep.
Dave, why don't you gentlemen come up? Whichever you two want to go first, and Representative, if you have other things, we won't hold against you if you depart on us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 2038. This bill definitely isn't related to water, and it definitely isn't related to land use, but it is related to rural communities. So we got one out of the three jobs of this committee. What the bill does is it amends Oregon's recreational use statutes. You can find them in Chapter 105. It's 105-668 into the 690s. The purpose of the recreational use statutes, and we've had these in Oregon for 20 years, the purpose of those can be found in the policy provisions. It's 105-676. The idea is, in order to encourage property owners, both public and private, to allow recreational use on their property, we allow for liability limitations for the property owner. So if someone is out, if you as a private property owner allow the public to enter onto your property for a recreational purpose, and in the course of that recreational purpose, the member of the public is hurt, you as the property owner are immune from liability for the injuries caused by that, as long as you're not charging a fee to the member of the public to come out and use the property. We've had that in Oregon since 1995, and we have a definition of recreational use in recreational purposes in the statutes. What this bill does is it adds to the definition of recreational purposes aviation-related activities. So in addition to, say, camping, picnicking, boating, swimming, hiking, cutting wood, gardening, whatever, we add to that definition hang gliding, parachuting, paragliding, operating airplanes or ultralight aircraft, or engaging in other aviation activity. we are not on the cutting edge here in Oregon with this particular amendment. I did a search this morning of our neighboring states, Arizona, and Arizona Revised Statutes 33.1551 includes the operation of aircraft as a recreational use. Washington, our neighbor to the north, in RCW 4.24.210 includes aviation activities in their recreational use statute. And all the state laws in the states surrounding us do the same thing. They give the private property or public or private property owner liability protection for if the property owner allows for recreational uses on their property, as long as they don't charge a fee for it. So Washington and Arizona recognize aviation. California, the California legislature in 2014, in California Civil Code Chapter 846, included aviation activities. So they did the same thing in California that we're asking you to do last year. Idaho, in Idaho Code Section 36.1604, recognizes aviation activities. Montana does as well. Nevada's a little bit different. They only recognize hang gliding and paragliding, apparently. We'll have to wait for a case where a farmer gets sued when somebody needs to make an emergency landing in their field and wrecks their plane and then sues the property owner, who had absolutely zero to do with the plane coming in and landing in the field. But for the most part, every state surrounding us has already done this, so we're not asking you to go out on a limb and create new law. We're just asking you to follow what all of your neighboring states have done. This is a good bill, a very limited bill, does not change the land use laws, and we certainly hope that you will support it.
Okay, thanks. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is on, I think, is it?
Yes. Slide it back just a bit, Phil. Otherwise, you distort. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Mr. Honeycutt has painted a pretty good picture of what this is. I live, by the way, I'm Philip R. Olson, live at 23725 Southeast Old Bethel Road in Amity in Yamhill County. My wife and I own farms in Yamhill County, and we also have one out in Harney County, on which both of those we have registered airstrips. Within the state of Oregon, there are over 323 of these airstrips, personal use restricted to landing by permission only, strips around the state. As a matter of fact, with the exception of Representative Helm and Representative Clem, because of probably their district being in more urban areas, all the rest of you have constituents that will be benefited by this passage of this bill. The recreational use statutes, to me, when I read, not being an attorney and running through a little bit of this with Representative Huffman in 2013, the problem exists not that that we aren't covered right now, when I say we, aviation, or the landowners from aviation intrusion, but when it comes to the language, the laws are written where it says included but not limited to. That becomes the problem, and that's what our statute is. So as Mr. Honeycutt pointed out, we want to make it clear so we don't have to pass two points of law to become covered on this. People say, well, what's the deal? I mean, people land on fields and they land on strips just because? Well, yeah, they do. They do that. And our strip out by Amity, on activities during the good flying times of the summer, I'll have at least a half a dozen airplanes land on my strip that I know nothing about. They just do it. And now, I happen to be aviation friendly. Am I particularly irritated about it? No. I kind of like, you know, howdy, nice looking airplane. But that's what they do. And so, you know, having an airstrip out there is, people think there's an airstrip, oh, it must be safe to land. The FAA has certain requirements of all pilots, and that is to get all available information pertinent to that flight, including the landing site. Now, if you can't call the FAA for a flight briefing to get it, you call the owner. Hey, what's going on? And what I tell people call me, I said, well, it's a little soft. That's a grass strip is what I have. I said, you know, but you make your own decision. Take a look at it. And at your own risk, of course, you know that. And there's no charge and no fee. I use the analogy, having an airstrip and people thinking it's always safe to land on is like taking one of my granddaughters out to a pond that's got ice in it and put skates on her and shove her across the ice. There's some testing we need to do, and that's what we as pilots do. Mr. Honeycutt was correct. West of the Mississippi, there are only two states that are conspicuous in not having aviation listed as a recreational use, one of which is Oregon, that's why we're here. Number two is Colorado. In total across the country, we have nearly, I believe it's a little over 30 is the number, from Florida to other points in the southeast. We're not remaking the wheel. This bill does mirror Washington's, and it's been worked very successfully there. And we have no reason to believe it won't be the same here. We do know that I've had a number of times where people would like to come in and, you know, and say, may I have permission to land in your airstrip because I'd like to tour the wine country. And many times I'll say, no, I don't want to do that. So they'll say, well, I guess we'll just go to Washington and look at their wine grapes up there on our amphitheater. We have that. I know that there's state efforts to get the use of, to get people to visit, obviously, many parts of the states. There are many, many more private restricted air strips for potential use than there are public ones. This is a spinoff for the good thing. I think you can get the message what it is trying to happen here. It is an important thing for those 328 plus landowners, plus the multitude. I believe you're going to hear testimony from other farmers and that have had instances of people landing on their strips unbeknownst to them. What's going to happen also is we think in the flying community and for the economy and jobs in Oregon, fuel sales, mechanics on airstrips, it's going to encourage more aviation activity because there'll be more potential landing sites after people get permission to do that. Every landowner can still say, no, thank you, you're not going to land on my strip. Hot air balloons are issues. I don't understand a provision where a hot air balloon is up there, and I understand this part of it, and he's run out of propane and needs to come down, so he comes down and lands in a farmer's field, and then he sues the farmer because his field was rough. I don't get it. That's what these kinds of things would take place in our aviation activities. So I think that's pretty much it from our perspective. You have another thing I'd like to point out. You have an enclosure here to show you. Actually, two of them I'll speak to just very, very briefly. One of which you have is a map. This is called an aviation sectional map. You can see this is around the Aurora State, which is one of the prize crown jewels, and is a state airport, one of the crown jewels of the state of Oregon for primarily general aviation, we call it, airstrips. All these other little circles around them are restricted. Ours are restricted, and that's restricted for a reason. I have a one that says restricted on it. People land there anyway. So we're making best efforts. The system requires people to call. They don't always. So there's the information is out there. It's required for a flight briefing prior to any flight to have, against, as I said, all the information available. Not all airports are charted. That's an FAA determination of what they want to chart. The other enclosure is something that I'm not going to go into at all, but it does lift. The upper part is that Mr. Honeycutt covered on why this fits in so nicely with the stated policy of the Legislative Assembly of a number of years ago to help shield landowners. But the second part, the lower part of that, is the FAA regulation stipulating of who has control. It's interesting, I would think, without the inclusion of aviation in our restricted recreational use statutes, which we're saying somehow the landowner is responsible, has liability, it would be a little bit like the FAA says that a pilot is responsible for the aircraft under all aspects of flight, except in Oregon, where the landowner is responsible for the landing. That's what it would kind of be. So all we're saying is, let's just bring it up to speed with the rest of the people, or the rest of the states around us.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
if I might ask Dave Honeycutt a question, because it dawned on me that some people might have the question, are we trying to alleviate negligence on the part of the landowner? And I think I'm fair in saying we're not trying to. If somebody's negligent, this is not going to apply. It's just... Am I correct in that?
Yeah, the liability protections, Mr. Chair, you can find in 105.682, and it's actually 105.682 sub 1. And it's except as provided in subsection 2, you have liability protection. And subsection 2 of that statute says, this section does not limit the liability of an owner of land for intentional injury or damage to a person coming onto land for recreational purposes, gardening, wood cutting, or the harvest of special forest products. So if there's intentional injury on behalf of the by the property owner, then the liability protections don't apply. But other than that, the liability protections do apply.
So this is sort of bizarre, but what do they do when they land and want to go see the wine field? Have somebody pick them up there in a car? Or
they
start
have,
walking?
That's the question I asked them. I said, you got your hiking boots?
Yeah.
Like, we happen to grow blueberries, you know. I'd be happy to sell you some blueberries, but I'm not going to charge you the land. I mean, I get it, but they didn't do that.
What else do they do? Get out, stretch their legs, use the bathroom, and get back up and go?
Let's look at it. Let's say somebody wants to land recreationally a helicopter on a vineyard. That could happen. They're out, a family owns a helicopter, they're flying around, they want to land on a vineyard. This would give liability protection to that vineyard operator.
Well, if they're charging him to buy wine or anything, it wouldn't.
Well, yeah. I'm not going to. We're free tasting day, I guess.
Yeah, that's the point. Is if it's incidental, if it's a business, and you know, I don't think this is meant to be used where that's your primary business, is to bring tourists out here, and we're trying to now get you to be able to land. It's more you're farming, and you have a strip that's related to. Your crop duster could use it, and
sure.
So now it's there, something like that. Why do you have strips? Is it for spray, or do you fly?
We have a small airplane.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. This is a very interesting deal.
Yeah. Or you may not have a strip at all, Mr. Chair. It's just land in the field.
Yeah. Hopefully not in my orchard. There's a lot of trees that could be a problem there. We've got some questions, so let's start with Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for my good friend, Representative Huffman. I see this bill deals with parachuting, hang gliding, ultralight aircraft, aircraft, and other aircraft activity. Does that include drones?
You know what, Mr. Chair and Representative Gomberg? It probably would be another flying machine that could be... although I have no drone bills. I'm leaving that up to other folks.
Okay, Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my question, too. And from a drafting point of view, I think people could say, you know, if you don't care, then that's fine. But if for some reason you didn't want unmanned aerial vehicles grouped with the other activities that you're adding, you might think about specifically excluding them at this point. Because I bet you somebody, some clever lawyer, might argue engaging in other aviation activity would be unmanned aerial vehicles, and they are crashing, aren't they?
Well, may I comment?
Absolutely.
I think we're looking at this as a landowner protection. If a drone lands on my field, do I want to be responsible for the drone? I think that's the question, not who's doing it, if a drone lands on my field, I still want the protection that I feel I'm getting on my strip. So I would say, yes, it is an aviation activity because it's protecting me. That's the question, I think.
I would jump in and say, however, based on the legislation 2710 that we passed in 2013, there are some potential civil actions that could be taken by a landowner because of trespass, things that we built into House Bill 2710 that regarding drones specifically, you might want to get permission before you go out and fly over somebody's house or property because of the, I think we put in the bill 400-foot elevation, you know, is basically considered the privacy area. So, yeah.
Okay. Vice Chair Post.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think, Mr. Olson, I think you probably just answered my question, but I think to go to this whole conversation, so what we're talking about here is not giving permission necessarily for people to land their stuff, but you are not responsible if the drone, the plane, the helicopter, the hang glider, the air, whatever.
Perfect.
You're safe.
Perfect.
I don't know. I just try to boil things down a little bit. Is that reasonable for everybody? Does that make sense? Okay, thanks.
We've got several more witnesses who could probably illuminate us with more stories about how this comes into play. So if there's none other for these gentlemen, we'll let them go.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you. I've got John McKinney, Feast Doublefield, and Marianne Nash. John first.
My name is John McKinney. I'm a commercial pilot from down in Lebanon and a property owner. I also sit on the Linn County Planning Commission. Everybody, I've spoken to five or six of my friends that own airstrips. Everybody's in favor of it. To answer your question a little bit about what we do, I have two small airplanes, and one of our favorite things to do is throw all our camping gear, our fishing poles in, and we go land at different places. We might land on the Willamette River, we might go up to Jeff's house, land at Jeff's house, spend the night, go camping. We got fold-up bicycles. If I decided to go land near a winery, we unfold our bicycles and ride our bicycles 5, 6, 7 miles one way somewhere, maybe spend the night, maybe not. We go down into Temperance Creek on the Snake River in Oregon and land down there at private ranches down there and spend the night. And if this is passed and more people open their airstrips up, it's going to provide more tourism dollars, more pilots will come in. We go into Idaho quite a bit and fly, and there might be 20, 30, 40 airplanes show up at a strip for an event or for a camp out or something like that. And every one of those planes, when you come from out of state, you're going to spend $2,000-$3,000 for the weekend. I mean, by the time my airplane holds $300 or $400 worth of gas, I mean, plus the food and the lodging and your fishing licenses, and it just goes on and on, but we think it's a real positive thing, and that's all I have to say.
Let's see, you Fee?
Yes. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, welcome. Thank you. Fee Stubblefield, Amity, Oregon. I'm a landowner. I'm a pilot, landowner in Yamhill County, landowner in agricultural landowner of Yamhill County, and also in Umatilla County. And the points that I see, there's from a landowner perspective, I very much like Mr. Olson, have people that come and land on my grass fields. I don't have an airstrip there, but it happens all the time. And right now, I guess I carry some amount of liability for that. Doesn't seem quite fair. Additionally, from the other side of it is, I can give you a couple of stories about. There's a lot of private airstrips out there that landowners are very disincentivized to let other pilots and people access and use. It's very restrictive. If you can afford to own land, if you can afford to own an airstrip, it's the liability is such, you talk to your attorney, you can't let people land there. You take a big risk unless you go through a lot of legal hoops and spend money and get named on additional insurance certificates. I know this because I've in Eastern Oregon, there's a very nice strip out there that I was unable to land at for many years until finally, in a lot of legal dollars, we drafted an agreement and provided insurance policies and did all of that. I think that passing this bill would allow for, it would open up a lot of our remote country to Representative Clem, people in your district don't have a lot of landing strips, but there's a lot of pilots there that have planes that would have access to other parts of the state that you just don't get right now. I think that the other point is that there's a safety issue here. I know of a pilot that owns a strip just north of Long Creek, and in talking to him one day when I was weathered in John Day, he told me about this nice paved strip, and I'd flown over the strip, and the strip has X's on it, and anytime you see a strip with X's, that means don't land there, it's unsafe. He doesn't have those X's on there because it's unsafe. It's a very safe runway. He does it because him and his attorney have figured out if he does that, there'll be less people landing on his strip, and it will reduce his liability. If I'm flying over there and I don't know that, and I have some type of engine trouble, I'm probably going to try a different emergency landing scenario, like landing on a road instead of landing on a perfectly good strip. There are several cases like that, maybe more in the state, where private landowners X out their strip, which tells people to stay away when it's not really the case. And the other point that's been mentioned before is I think this could lead to some robust benefit for the aviation industry, which is really struggling in Oregon right now. A lot of people go to Idaho. A lot of people go to Montana. We've got a lot of great country out there that could be accessed if property owners just felt a little more safe and secure for giving permission. So, thank you.
Marianne.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here with the Oregon Farm Bureau, and we also support this bill. From our perspective, I think it provides important landowner protection for landowners that authorize use of their property, whether it's for emergency landings. In Eastern Oregon, you have a lot of paragliders, hot air balloons, hang gliders that, you know, tend to come back again and again to a certain piece of property. And it provides really important protection to landowners that authorize use of their property for those purposes and for other emergency uses.
Any question for these two? Okay.
Thank you.
We have Jeff Stevenson, John Heiser, and Scott Powell come on up. Jeff, I've got you first.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. I'm a property owner in Linn County. We have a Green Trees Ranch airstrip that is about 20 miles southeast of Salem here. And it was established over 45 years ago as a private strip.
Sorry, Jeff, I have to have you say your name for the microphone one time.
Jeff Stevenson.
Great. That's okay. Good enough. Thanks.
All right. And I'm just here in support of the bill. It just makes a whole lot of sense. We've owned this property for 15 years, and I'll just reiterate what you've heard from some of the others. Yes, people just fly in and just land. I mean, can you imagine somebody just driving into your driveway and getting out and stretching their legs? And I mean, but aviation's a little different. People do that. And so, you know, we've sought out legal advice, and we've currently ours is privately owned by permission only. And we've questioned our attorney about it, and his advice was, don't answer the phone. Don't talk to them. Don't give them permission. If they land, they're trespassing. I mean, which is a whole different tact. And the reason we're there is we're aviation. We love aviation. Both my wife and myself are pilots. And the whole reason we're there is because we love aviation, and we love fellow aviators. It was courteous. It would be nice to have them call and let us know they're coming, but we certainly don't discourage it. General aviation is in a big spiral dive, and certainly anything we can do to support it, we're all for it. And I just think it makes perfect sense that if the other forms of recreation are afforded the the liability release, then this should be included in that as well. So I think that's basically what I have to say.
Good. Thanks, John. Do we have a John here?
Yes. John Heiser. My wife and I own a farm in Yamhill County that borders the Willamette River on Grand Island. The previous legislation that limits liability for recreational use has allowed us to feel better about letting people come on our property to hunt and fish. and so has opened up opportunities to the public. And adding aviation activities to the recreational purposes covered under the limited liability legislation just really makes sense to add one more recreational opportunity that people do. We're not directly on the flight path of a lot of the hot air balloons that travel from Newburgh down the valley, but we see them on a regular basis, and it's a beautiful sight. And if they needed to put down in our farm field, it would be a very cool experience. But it would really be unfortunate if that resulted in an accident and us being liable for that accident. So I would just ask your support to add aviation uses.
And Scott.
Okay, and my name is Scott Powell, and I'm a landowner in Polk County. There's a private grass strip on that property. It's registered with the State Department of Aviation, and it is identified and located on sectional maps published by the federal government. By that registration and documentation, it in fact there's an awareness above the by the aviating public that it exists, and perhaps an invitation for them to land there, and they have done so. I'm in favor of House Bill 2038. From the landowners' perspectives, guests who land on the airstrip differ little from hunters, hikers, picnickers, horseback riders who use it, most by permission, but not all. This bill would add a little bit to my comfort level of sharing my public or my private property with the public, and it would increase my spirit of, as I say, comfort, but also cooperation and generosity and sharing of my land with them. Also, it adds a little bit of a thin layer, I would say, of liability protection when members of the public use it. I would observe that it costs nothing to the taxpayer to enact this, which is a positive, and it gives the citizen taxpayer a little bit on the positive side. Harms nobody except perhaps the trial lawyers, and I would offer only a sliver, and that all the lawsuits that can now be filed can still be filed. It might give the landowner a little more power to stiff arm the most frivolous of those lawsuits. So I think it's a positive addition to the body of law in the state of Oregon, and I recommend its passage.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Chairman, I like this bill. I like the direction it's heading. I like the conversation we're having here. And I applaud your generosity in opening your property, your private property, to the public. My question is, do these kinds of protections encourage more trespass for people who may not be as welcoming as you might be? Do we make it easier to justify landing or trespassing on other people's property?
I think there would be a slow awareness by the general population of this provision. Landowners might be mostly aware of it, but the general flying public and picnicking public might be less aware, and I don't predict that there will be any mammoth onslaught of uninvited guests out, but when they do arrive, there's a little bit of legal protection for me when they do.
Questions for these three gentlemen?
Okay. Could I just add, sure. And reiterate the use of the strip as an emergency strip. And in our case, we're about 800 or 900 feet above the valley floor, and quite often it will be fogged in over the valley, and we're in the clear. And we have had numerous times in the past where pilots have come across the Cascades to come back into the valley and have run out of options, and they've landed at our place, which makes perfect sense. And I would encourage anybody that was in that situation to do that. But as a landowner, you know, I've got my neck stuck out, and so passing this sort of bill would make me able to sleep a little bit easier at night. And I certainly wouldn't want anybody to shoo anybody away that really needed the facility in that sort of time. But so, and as a whole, when your question about if there can be an influx, more activity, I think your statement, it would be kind of a slow awareness. I agree with that. And the pilot group as a whole, my experience has been, are a pretty responsible lot. We have, in fact, had incidents in the past at our strip, and you know, it's always been land at your own risk. And so in the past incidents, the pilots have taken full responsibility, and there's never been a problem. But there's always one rotten egg in the bunch, so we're just trying to dodge that one.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's have Mary Rosenblum and Bill Wainwright. And Arthur, go ahead and join them if you like. Yeah, got room for three.
Ready?
Mm-hmm. Mary, go ahead.
Yes, I'm Mary Rosenblum. I live in Canby. I'm part owner of a private airstrip. I am also president of Oregon Pilots Association, and I am a member of the State Aviation Board. I just came from a board meeting. Broke a couple of speed limits coming down here, too. I'd like to speak from all three of my positions, my little schizophrenic position here. First, I want to speak as a landowner. I'm part owner of Dietz Air Park, a private, not public, airstrip near Canby, in Canby. And we have carry liability insurance, and we carry liability insurance for the person that comes down, makes a bad landing, and his insurance company tries to sue us for whatever. We have members of our community who really do discourage people inviting friends to land and visit. For that reason, they're concerned about liability or our premiums increasing. And this is going to ease some of that burden on us. You've heard some of the issues about, for example, I know his airstrip. I've never landed there. But there are times when that is one of the few strips available in the valley, and if you don't have enough fuel to get back over to Bend, you better put it down somewhere. It's not pleasant trying to land in the fog. I would like to speak to the issue of pilots landing without permission. Unfortunately, I don't want you gentlemen to have the perception that we go around landing wherever we choose to. We have a few people who land without permission when they see a place to put the plane down. But, you know, I have friends that have acreage out near Enterprise, and they have people who drive up their ungated roads to go hunt or picnic without permission, too. I mean, it happens. You have people who do that. Most pilots do ask permission. I've never landed at a private strip without permission first. And you're actually required by the FAA to seek all possible information about a flight, including landing, before you take off. That, the only way you can seek all possible information is to call the landowner and find out what the condition of the strip is. So the people who do that are already in violation of FAA statutes and the FARs and are open to a punishment by the FAA, which tends to be substantial. So speaking to this, as an Oregon Pilots Association president, I want to say that this does open up a lot of land. We have some beautiful areas in eastern Oregon, especially in southern Oregon, and some very nice little grass strips where people have X'd them out or they simply don't allow people because of liability concerns. And recreational pilots go to Idaho. And if you heard the earlier testimony, spending $2,000 near that Idaho strip for gas and for meals and for recreational activities. And there are some very nice strips that are close to small towns, and if landowners were a little more comfortable with granting permission, for someone to come in and walk a couple of miles into town or fish in the river or what have you. We are opening up land for recreational use. I fly a small plane. I love to fly into the backcountry and go camping or fish. That's why I have a fishing license, is for that use. And so we are opening up areas for more recreational use that are going to benefit our state. As a board member for the State Aviation Board, we did support this officially last time it came up, and we do support it. We have not been able to make an official letter of support because of the current transition, but the board is unanimously in agreement that this is a good measure for the State Aviation Board to support, and I am assuming that we will be officially supporting it. So, any questions?
Thanks. Bill?
Hello. Bill Wainwright, Mr. Chairman and board members, thank you for your time today. I'm a property owner and a farm owner in Polk County. I own 400 acres, and I have a private airstrip on my property that I maintain for my own use, but I've had folks from time to time come in and land, as a lot of people have. I have no objection to that. It always comes to my mind, well, what about liability? My family asked me that question, and my answer to this point has been, well, we do have a recreational use statute, and I believe the people that have come there are out recreating. So I felt there's some coverage, but I think adding this at this point is really a timely action to clarify the protection that the landowners have. Thank you, and hope you'll support this bill.
And Arthur.
Hello. excuse me. My name is Arthur Towers, and I represent the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Chair Klein, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. Shockingly, we'll be taking the opposing point of view on this bill from previous witnesses. But it's important to understand that what's being proposed today is what I would characterize as a pretty extreme step. That you've heard today from quite a few folks who are going to be acting responsibly and acting responsibly in the operation of their property or their airstrip. But in that instance, when the airstrip operator is somehow grossly negligent, the facts of the individual case should actually matter. And what is being proposed today would preclude the actual facts of what actually happens in a given instance from coming into play in the determination of fault and negligence. And when you do that, then victims' rights vanish. And so in the, you know, what would strike me as an unusual situation, you know, the ones that people have described, they feel much more run-of-the-mill. But in the unusual situation where the airplane operator is acting reasonably and somehow the airstrip a landowner has acted unreasonably, there may be instances where you want the victim to have the opportunity to go to court over that. And, you know, in other settings, we've, you know, seen where there's been problems with the law, and we've had to do a kind of a one-off for an individual case. And so I just wanted to bring that perspective to the conversation, that what we're talking about here in terms of blanket immunity is just that. It's a blanket, and it does go a long ways covering a variety of different circumstances that we might not be able to foresee today. So I'll leave it there and be happy to answer any questions, or at least attempt to. Thank you.
Questions for this panel?
Could I make one more comment?
yeah, please.
Yeah, to take that approach would be the same as saying that, you know, the law as it now applies to fishing and hunting and all those other activities that the law already applies, you know, that, you know, that it's also flawed. So I think that here we have a situation that, you know, is not intended to alleviate a landowner of something that's his gross negligence. And that's my comment.
But just, Chair Clement, if I can respond.
Sorry. No, go ahead, and then we'll bring Representative Post in.
Representative Post, please go ahead, because I seem to have forgotten what I was going to say.
Let's stay, because we may have a question for you.
Sorry.
Vice Chair
Post. Might have forgotten mine, too. No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to, maybe without belaboring and taking the rest of the day. So Bill's place, Bob's flying, lands, maybe Bill has barbed wire across a stretch where they had to make an emergency landing or whatever. They rip through the barbed wire and everybody gets chopped to pieces, but they survive. And so I'm trying to find, where does Bill's fault come into play and why? So help me, because I'm really struggling with this.
Chair Clem, Representative Post. I mean, as I was listening to the testimony, which was I found pretty compelling, the example that crossed my mind is there's a clear practice you have to take part in. If you feel your airstrip is unsafe, you exit out. What if you haven't exited out? I'm sure there are other people here who can answer that question better than I can. But I mean, you're supposed to mark, from the testimony today, you're supposed to mark your airstrip as unsafe if it's unsafe. And so, now, again, in my mind, the individual facts matter. So, say the airstrip should have been X'd out. It wasn't X'd out. The person should have called to land, didn't call to land. You know, how does that sort itself out? Again, I feel like it's hard for the legislature to presume, you know, to limit the liability when there are going to be some cases, a handful of cases, I think, where people are going to be victimized by negligent landowners. Again, many? No. You know, maybe hell no. But son of a gun, there'll be a few, and then we'll be back in the situation where we're going to have to deal with, you know, an individual law for an individual case. And that's problematic.
Follow up. I guess what I'm trying to get at is for whatever reason, how can it ever be the landowner's fault if somebody drops down on their land? They have no idea that this is coming down. How can it? So I'm new to this. You got to help me here. How can it ever be the landowner's fault?
So
or problem.
So, Chair Clem, Representative Post. I can't provide you a very good answer to that question, because my sense of things is that in 99% of the episodes that, you know, I would agree with you that the flying a plane is inherently risky, you know, but I could imagine a handful of circumstances like the one I just described where it's conceivable that the landowner was somehow grossly negligent.
And I want to maybe get back to that question. I think maybe it was Mr. Honeycutt's testimony that talked about where else the negligence still applies part of this. So I want to get, because I'm not a lawyer, so I want to understand how these recreational statutes and what standard of negligence is excused, basically, and what isn't excused in here. And somebody talked about that earlier. I just don't remember who it was now. Representative Gilliam?
Yes. Thank you, Clerk Jeff. Arthur, can you conceive of an amendment that would cover the 1% that you referred to that we could consider for this bill?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, I'd be happy to talk it over with folks and try to puzzle it out. We're in the process of trying to reach some sort of compromise on that in the agritourism industry. And a bill over on the Senate side. So happy to have that conversation.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if there's really, you know, whatever, 30 other states that have a statute, if any have some other sideboards maybe around them, besides not charging. Not charging, to me, is the most obvious thing. If you're charging, then that's part of your business. You should get commercial insurance because, you know, you can factor that in. But if you're not doing it, you know, and you... What is, I don't know exactly what the sideboard amendment is, if there is one, but I can see your point. It'd be interesting to see if, I don't know if you have that kind of network, but it'd be interesting to see in states that have it, if there are cases where somebody on the listserv says, oh, no, we had a case like that. Here's what happened, but they couldn't do anything, and it was a really bad example. So we had something live to work from. But I don't know if you have national listservs like that, the way we do in Oregon, where you can bounce stuff around a little bit. Other questions? And then did you have one more point you wanted to make?
Yes, yeah. I did want to speak to that, which is that as far as landowner liability goes, because the pilot is legally required to pursue all avenues of information, that means they must call the landowner first. It's not enough to overfly the strip. There may be barbed wire. There may be a cow that wanders out in front of you. Many people graze their animals on their strip. If that person fails to follow the FARs that all of us who pass our pilot exam and become pilots are required to follow, and fails to contact the landowner and lands and hits that horse or hits that barbed wire fence, that is the pilot's failure to do what the FAA has said the pilot must do. And the FAA will consider that to be pilot liability. And the pilot will lose their license, be punished with fines, however the FAA chooses to do it. So why the landowner should ever be penalized for someone failing to follow what they're required to do as a pilot is beyond me.
And then that begs the question, if the FAA is taking care of this, then what's the need for the legislation?
It's simply defining.
The scenario, I guess I could see, is you call and you say, can I land? The person says, yeah, fine, go ahead. Then the cow runs out after you've given it
permission. Or they have a barbed wire fence, and right. They tell someone, sure, you can land, knowing they will hit the barbed wire fence. There you have negligence, but right. That sounds more like manslaughter to me, actually.
But would that, in that, so just taking it one step further, in that case, would this bill let the landowner off the hook?
That's where I think we need to root out what is still possible under negligence. What level of negligence does this actually protect you from? And if it's too much, then maybe we need some different language. But we have to have somebody. Mr. Honeycutt, why don't you make your way back up?
Right.
And we're going to move on. Arthur, you can stay if you have a legal explanation maybe to counter. Yeah. But I think if we're okay on time for now, but we're going to run out here pretty quick.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt, just to answer the question, given the fact pattern of the pilot flying overhead, seeing the X-Dot airport and landing there, as the last witness indicated, before you take off, you call the owner of the strip in which you where you wish to land, and you ask about the conditions of the airport, of the strip. If the property owner who had the X-Dot unsafe strip were to inform the pilot, go ahead and land there, then at that point it goes from being negligence to being intentional, and under the under 105.682 sub 2, the liability protections don't apply for intentional injury or damage to a person coming onto the land for recreational purposes. So that hypothetical doesn't fit with the fact pattern of this particular case. I also just to quickly respond to Mr. Towers, he indicated that this was an extreme piece of legislation. Again, I would remind you that this legislation, and I can provide you with all the sites to all the neighboring states, but the neighboring states all have this legislation already, so we're not asking you to step out onto a limb.
So, Dave, in the way the bill's structured, I do see that it adds into 105.672, but then down in the liabilities, it says the section does not limit the liability of an owner of land for intentional injury or damage coming onto land for recreational purposes, gardening, wood cutting. So by adding into the definition of recreational purposes, then you're automatically pulling this into that statute. Is that the way this is structured?
Mr. Chair, all that the amendment does is it adds those definitions to the definition of recreational purposes. The rest of the statutes remain in effect, and so the provision in 105.682 sub 2, which we're not amending with this bill, remains and would apply to any of the uses, hunting, fishing, aviation, any of the other uses, so we're not changing that.
Yeah, I see. I think what threw me off was I was thinking of these other things as recreational, but that's not the way it is. Recreational is one list of things like picnicking, hiking, boating, and then gardening, woodcutting, or the harvest is not, so they're called out.
Right.
They're not recreational, apparently.
Yeah,
but
and the point of the statutes to begin with was to encourage private landowners and the public, this applies to public land as well, to encourage both the public and private landowners to allow people to come out for free to make recreational use of the property.
Okay. Representative McLean.
Yeah, Dave, does intentional torts are excluded? What about ultra-hazardous activities? For an example, let's say God forbid I ever did this, but let's say I raised pit bulls, and my pit bulls escaped and harmed someone, so I was cited, or, you know, and I had these pit bulls. So someone lands a plane on my private airstrip and is immediately attacked and maimed by my pit bulls. That's an unforeseeable risk. And it seems to me that one of the issues is not just its foreseeability on one, but ultra-hazardous activities that, I mean, ultimately it's like the burglar suing the homeowner because they were keeping the toxic waste in the living room when I ripped off the TV. So the I'm curious how that applies under this. Intentional torts, the person who was injured can still sue for an intentional tort. They're banned under this amendment for negligence. Is there, where does ultra-hazardous activity or a known risk?
Mr. Chair, before he answers that question, the representative meant to say, what if there were dangerous dogs? We don't need the Humane Society.
Oh, to pick on pit bulls today? Okay. If there's a breed that's dangerous out there, then what?
The scarhead and big fangs.
Yeah.
I don't mean to pick on pit bulls. Thank you, Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, I don't believe that, well, I'm 99.9% sure, I haven't shepherdized the statutes, but I'm 99.9% sure that there hasn't been a case that's tested that theory, that's tested that fact pattern. All I can tell you is that the limitation on the liability protection in 105.682(1), I think is pretty broad. The limitation in 105.682(2) is the only, I believe, the only limiting factor. And that would apply to the intentional injury or damage caused by the person.
If I could follow up.
Sure.
So what you're asking, which I think is reasonable, is that all these activities regard people landing, going from air, transfer to on the ground. And all you're saying is all those things that are foreseeable risks in doing so are hereby waived should you do it on private property. Or,
well, for, Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, public or private property. And it's based on the idea that the pilot, before he or she lands on a particular airstrip, needs to, if it's restricted, if it's labeled as restricted, needs to contact the property owner ahead of time and make sure that the strip is somewhere that's safe to land.
Okay.
It's the pilot's responsibility, not the property owner's responsibility, especially when the landing occurs and the property owner has no idea that it's coming.
And if I may follow.
Sure.
So, and it's just for those risks under the definition of negligence that are foreseeable with landing?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I think we have gotten through everybody on my list. Anybody else here on this issue? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2038 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2444. I'm going to ask Lisa and Stephanie to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We bring before you today House Bill 2444. This is an agency bill that we are proposing to align our farm mediation program in statute with what it does today in practice. This program is a small program in the department. It was established during the farm credit crisis in the 1980s. It was built around foreclosures. Over time, and some changes in USDA regulations, the department stopped doing foreclosures, and that went to another entity. And in 1997, the legislature broadened the language related to the mediation program, allowing the department to enter into mediations with other disputes directly related to department activities and agricultural issues under its jurisdiction. So today, most of the mediation cases that come to the department are related to labor. We have some nuisance cases, and I think in the last several years there was a drift case, which was a neighbor-to-neighbor issue that sometimes we mediate. As I said earlier, this bill simply really aligns what we're doing today. And with that, I'm going to let Stephanie talk about some more of the specifics because she knows the program much better than I.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Stephanie Page with Oregon Department of Agriculture. A little more background on why the program exists. Its goal is really to be a lower cost and more efficient alternative to solving disputes in the court system. And it's consistent with state law, which encourages mediation as an alternative to either leaving disputes unresolved or by resolving them through the court system. It's a much lower cost and faster way for both parties to solve these issues. We conduct anonymous surveys post-mediation for all of the participants in the program, so they can mail those surveys to us anonymously. Out of the surveys we've received, 98% of respondents have indicated they would recommend the program to someone else as a way to resolve a dispute. As Deputy Director Hansen said, most of the cases the program handles are labor disputes, so wage and hour, harassment, cases like that. We have three mediators on contract who take these cases and work with the parties to see if a settlement can be reached. There's no pressure to achieve a settlement. It's just if the parties believe that they can arrive at an agreement. And we take about 12 cases per year, and the cases last an average of about 6 hours. I would be happy to take you through the sections of the bill to summarize the changes section by section, or we would be happy to answer questions about it as well.
Why don't we see if we have questions about it? Any mediation-related questions out of this crew? Yeah, I didn't think so. anything more you want to tell us about this bill?
I think, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2444. And we've got some work sessions. I'm probably the only one who actually wasn't here for these, so I'm going to have to trust the good graces of the committee. Otherwise, I'm going to have to go back and listen to these. We've got the two from Business Oregon that we heard about the other day. Is there any discomfort from anybody with working those bills at the moment? Okay. So let me open the work session on House Bill 2435. And we'll just split them up.
Okay.
Vice Chair Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House Bill 2435 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Helms moves House Bill 2435 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye.
Motion passes and the bill is sent to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And let me open a work session on House Bill 2436.
Mr. Chairman, did you want to determine how that bill is
Ways and Means, Carrie,
you mean? Yes, yeah, I thought about you. That, right, the last second?
Yes.
Vice Chair Post, you've got something for me on 2436?
Yes, I do.
Oh,
how are you?
Not bad.
It's nice to have you here today. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2436, dated February 16th of 2015.
Vice Chair Post moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2436, dated 2/16. It might only be for my benefit, but do we have any brief description of what the Dash 1 amendment is?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendment simply adds corporations or companies for drainage or flood control to the list of organizations that may receive financial assistance in the form of loans or grants for the levy project.
Okay, any discussion on these Dash 1s? Any objection to the Dash 1s? If not, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Post, I'm ready for the next motion.
Chair Clem, I move that House Bill 2436 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the committee, Joint Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2436 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomber?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent down to Ways and Means. And the committee just stand at ease for 1 second. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2148.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2148.
Vice Chair Helm moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2148. Does anybody need an explanation of these?
Would you?
Yeah, if you could.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendment clarifies the permanent improvements are only exempt from state and local fees, and that charges and assessments are simply related to property taxation.
Okay, any discussion on these Dash 2s? Any objection to the Dash 2s? Tribes are fine with it, I assume, or you'd be up here. Yeah. Seeing no objections, Dash 2s are so adopted, and the bill itself.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2148 as amended move to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2148 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Representative McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, colleagues, I asked that this bill be amended to be clear that it was to conform to federal law, which has a preemption. And the proponents of the bill were willing to do that. I do think their interpretation of federal law is correct. However, the Department of Revenue, who's here today, objected to that. And the Department of Revenue, in the end, I believe, has a different viewpoint of federal law than at least the Ninth Circuit does. And that's created uncertainty. I certainly hope the Revenue Committee presses in, because I think by adopting this, we're about to set policy. And so while that's certainly the prerogative of our branch, I think the inconsistency with the executive branch's viewpoint on this area is not confined to this specific tribal issue. And so my request is that the Department of Revenue certainly engage with the Revenue Committee. We haven't had time to really understand why they have a different interpretation of federal law. I do think the bill should have had very clear in it that we're doing this to comply with federal law, because what's going to happen now is that the language stays the same. 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, federal law could change, but this policy will not. And so the issue is what's guiding us if we really are, as a proponent say, trying to make it very clear so that development can move forward, and that investors can be assured of state action, then I'm not so sure that will be achieved based upon this bill, given the fact that our Department of Revenue differs. So I'm supporting it because I do think it's the right interpretation of federal law. That's how I read the Ninth Circuit case. But I certainly respect our Department of Revenue. But I do think it's wise that our state governments' branches be clear before we pass what is tantamount to a policy that will guide private investment. Because to receive that certainty, private investors, I think, would want more than, would not want to see the Department of Revenue hold a different position. So that needs to be smoked out. And for those, based on that kind of nerdy comment, I would say I support the bill. I just think the Revenue Committee needs to flesh it out.
I'd like to hear Representative Gilliam's legal analysis of that exact question.
Thank you, Claire. I wrote most of the bullet points for Representative Clayton.
Okay.
And on a serious note, I hope that you'll chime in when revenue, we're referring it to revenue, correct, on your point.
We'll sign that to Representative Davis since he left us and traded you out
that's
for
good,
him.
That's a good
I know that Representatives Benson Davis would be a bit shy to express their opinions on.
Also mentees of mine.
Yeah.
Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Klein.
Aye.
Motion passes and the bill is sent to revenue. Anything else?
Yes,
for
Claire,
Representative.
Since you started it, I just wanted you to know that I was hesitant to move bills today because of your absence. I want you to know how glad I am you're back. But I also want you to know that you have two very capable vice chairs in, I think it's Herr Chelm and Pair Host, and I just think you can be confident when you're done, when you're away.
I heard you had some interesting guests from the public on a topic unrelated to any of the bills in front of you that day, and it was handled very well by my vice chair.
Mr. Chair, unrelated is often in the eye of the beholder.
Yes, it's true. That's true. With that, I will adjourn our committee. Thank you.
Often when
adjourn our committee. Thank you.